This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to Passing the Picket.
A countrywide bank strike begins this morning following the breakdown of peace talks at the Labour Relations Commission last night.
No one knows whether this will be a long or a short banks dispute. It's the first national stoppage in the banks since 1976.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker.
More than 1,300 branches are being picketed this morning on the first day of the National Bank strike. AIB, Bank of Ireland, National Irish and the Ulster Bank say they will provide a service in spite of the stoppage by the IBOA.
Labour Minister Brian Cowan again called on both sides to get back talking tonight. At a time of rising unemployment, we can do without this dispute, he said.
In 1992, Ireland experienced its first strike in the banking industry since the 1970s. Against a backdrop of unemployment which had hit 20%, rapid technological change, and the arrival of competition in the marketplace in the shape of Building Society Banking, the Irish Bank Officials Association and the major commercial banks in this country went head-to-head in a remarkably acrimonious three-week dispute, which, as you'll hear, created bitter and lasting divisions within the banking industry.
Before the 92 strike, there was a very strong union, the IBOA, with the ability to take action and use their muscle against the banks quite successfully, especially in the 60s, and then in a very, very long dispute, 7-month dispute in 1970.
That's Brian Sheehan, and he's the editor of Industrial Relations News. He covered the strike in 1992, and he recalls the atmosphere between the banks and the union in the run-up to the strike in the early 1990s.
By 1992, there'd been a lot of change in the banking world, technological change, management strategies and so forth. And management took a more human resources-led approach at that time. They wanted to create a direct relationship with their employees, which the union saw as overly aggressive. And management suggested that was necessary to counter union power. And there were strong emotions on each side. And this generated a lot of anger and posturing.
Larry Broderick is the current General Secretary of the IBOA. Back in 1992, he was assistant to his predecessor, Ciarán Ryan. He gives his recollection of the mood in the industry at that time.
Well, it was fairly tense, it's fair to say. We noticed in IBOA a very significant attempt by the banks to move away from collective bargaining and really focus on reducing costs and maximising profit. And I suppose the lead up to the 1992 dispute was the banking industry decided to, first of all, incentivise managers to move out of IBOA negotiated salaries and move towards performance-related pay. And that was a significant development because managers historically were very much part of the IBOA. Indeed, many members got their first application from their manager. And the second thing the industry did was probably bring in the whole two-tier recruitment. The new staff were brought in on very inferior terms and conditions of employment. So there was a build-up, I suppose, from our perspective, that there was preferential treatment, with senior managers now being well looked after, staff being exploited, and costs being reduced and profits being maximised. So that created the climate, I suppose, that launched a kind of a salary claim that really was the start of the debate that ran into a major dispute in 1992.
One of the industrial relations executives who the IBOA were involved in negotiations with at the time was Niall Saul. Back then he worked for National Irish Bank, he now works for Irish Life and Permanent. He identifies the issues at stake from the bank's perspective.
What really brought it to a head in the 1990s was the fact that the banks were starting to come into an area of quite severe competition because legislation was changing to allow the building societies essentially to sell products that were previously only sold by the associated banks, so current accounts and things like that. And in addition to that, competition within the market was such that the margins were falling anyway. Labour costs were very high as a proportion of overall costs, and it was really a situation that was just on a path that had to be addressed.
What also had to be addressed from the bank's point of view at that time was the increasing power of the IBOA, which at the beginning of the strike represented 14,000 bank officials across all grades of banking. Niall Saul makes no secret of the fact that the time had come to take on the might of the union.
the IBOA operated a policy with the banks that you could only come in at the base level in the banks and then rise through the banks. In fact, when I was appointed, and there were one or two other people appointed by different banks in around 1990, essentially what happened was that the IBOA wrote in protest at these people being brought in at higher levels. So what you were getting was the management structure in the banks was actually people who had actually started in the bank, and they didn't know a lot outside of the banking world, whereas a fair number of us who had come in had experienced competition in other industries and approaching it with a different sense. It often happens in the history of industrial relations that you get a situation where either the employer is unduly dominant or the union are unduly dominant. And the IBOA, in my view, had become unduly dominant in the banking industry prior to 1992, and there was a need for a correction of that balance. If you look back over the history of the banks, there were things that you would have seen as being just fundamentally almost feudal in their treatment of people. Like, you couldn't grow a beard work in the bank. If you were going to get married, you had to write to the directors asking for permission, and they would check out your intended spouse to see if they were okay, you know. And I mean, it's no surprise to me that people went into some kind of organised resistance to that, and that manifested itself in the establishment of the IBOA. But I think what had happened by 1990 is that the balance had switched across to the other side, and there was just a need for a recalibration of that balance.
The banks were looking at the issue of longer opening hours, and they positioned the issue of longer opening hours as part of, in response to our claim on salary. So their strategy was, I suppose, marginalise the union, get managers to support local initiatives to bring in change, and at the same time, let's have longer opening hours for the customers. We really saw this very early on, that this was about a marginalisation of the union. And as the dispute began to emerge, it really wasn't about pay at all.
When you looked at Irish banking versus any other competition, and we did this, Irish banks at the time were only open 22 hours a week. They used to close at 3 o'clock. And there were two other countries that had the same opening hours as us, and one of them was Tonga. I can't remember what the other one was offhand. But every other part of the industrial world had branches that were open when the customer wanted to do business.
So, while that was the prevailing climate of the day, what then was the catalyst which gave rise to the strike? Brian Sheehan.
The basic issue in 1992 was an IBOA claim for 6% in excess of the then national agreement, the PESP. Now, under the PESP, 3% was available for the bank to pay for change. The bank rejected the 6% claim, offered the 3%, in fact offered just 2% of it for change, which was extended opening hours at the time. The Labour Court issued a recommendation basically backing the bank's position because no union could be seen to breach the terms of a national agreement. Even a union like the IBOA, which is outside the ICTU.
Well, the issue started about pay, because our members certainly felt that the banks were not paying national wage agreements to the senior executives or indeed to managers. They had bought them off through performance-related pay. The new staff were brought into all banks now on inferior terms and conditions of employment. And of course, the bank at the time also launched many packages, so people were able to take voluntary severance and leave the banks. So we had a young group of staff coming in all banks who were a bit disillusioned, to say the least. Now they had a good bank job, but were finding themselves being paid significantly less than their colleagues, and more importantly, a lot less than their managers who were on this performance-related pay element.
The core issue was that about 3 years prior to that, an agreement had been reached between the IBOA and the banks on a so-called technology agreement. That agreement had worked pretty well. It had brought an increase in pay for staff and was working fairly well. The problem was that around 1990-1991, conversations with the IBOA, it was becoming clear that their view was that this technology agreement was due to expire, I think, in 1992, and they expected that there would be a new technology agreement for renegotiation, read extra money. And the banks set their face against that and decided that this was the battleground on which they were going to address the issue of the IBOA.
Our strategy all along was not to engage in an all-out strike, because we genuinely began to realise as we got into this dispute that the banks were probably not for changing, and their agenda was probably far more broader than just refusing a pay claim. And we sensed this very early on. And again, conscious of our own strategy not to have an all-out strike, we developed probably one of the most sophisticated tools for industrial action ever used by any union, certainly in the financial services industry or elsewhere. We decided to put a ban on commissions for customers in terms of various commercial transactions, like foreign exchange and like referrals. Basically, customers were coming in and you wouldn't be charged commissions. And obviously, customers would be delighted with that. But it created a huge reaction from the banks.
We took a view that that was a situation where the union were recommending to their people to move away from their contracts of employment. So we took the view that they weren't fulfilling their contracts of employment. And unless they returned to doing that, we would commence to dock their pay proportionate to the amount of the insurance business in the branch.
Within days, the reaction in three banks was to say to staff that if you support the IBUA line, we'll reduce your salary by 20%. An amazing response. AIB stayed silent for a couple of days, but dramatically, on the 12th of March, what AIB did was they selected staff randomly and actually suspended over 1,000 staff. So we had a very long day on the 12th of March, which changed the whole dimensions.
Talks were held at the LRC, and of course the big issue, the big question was, to what extent would the IBOA get a full support for their dispute? Traditionally, branch managers had been involved in the IBOA and would have been quite active members. But around the late 80s, the Bank of Ireland and AIB in particular had endeavoured to create a situation where they would move their bank managers away from the traditional salary scales that existed and into a different system, which would be an individual contract based on a competitive salary. What happened was that quite a number of their managers actually moved away and onto this new approach, which meant that they were no longer represented by the IBOA as such. But the test was going to come when the IBOA would call a dispute. Would the managers come in or would they not come in? Because what had happened in all the previous disputes was that the banks just closed and nobody came in. And I remember we were at conciliation on the Saturday before the dispute was due to start on the Monday. Kieran Mulvey had just taken over as CEO of the LRC. And I can remember him saying to us, you know, like the history of these disputes is that when IBOA ask for support, they get it. And so all of your branches are going to be closed. And I remember us saying to him that we were prepared to give him odds that that wouldn't be the case. And he said, well, you know, history is against you. And we said, well, would we be stupid enough now to put a bet with you today, knowing that if your position is right and places are completely closed, that we'd be back here on Wednesday with our tails between our legs looking for a settlement? So we said our belief was that sufficient people would come in, both managers and staff, that would enable the banks to open.
We gave AIB 3 days to reinstate the staff and allow for further discussions. There was another reason that we actually gave them 3 days. We had no pickets. We never intended to have a strike. And we had to go to our printer and print up over 1,200 pickets. I didn't tell them that then, but that is a fact. So we had to get pickets. They refused to engage. So we placed pickets on any branch or location where staff had been suspended. And that was the start of the dispute.
I remember on the Saturday evening, we tried to say to ourselves, what's the headline we'd like to see in the papers on the Monday? And we said, you know, something like, all banks open despite dispute. And I think if you look at the Herald on the Monday evening, it was banks stay open as IBOA's strike fails to take root.
At the end of the first day of full picketing, the banks say they've succeeded in maintaining full service to their customers, but the IBOA are claiming significant success for their action.
During the dispute early on, we had this thing within AIB that we refused to take commissions. And the bank targeted particular branches to close. And one of them was in Dundalk. So I had to organise one of the very early strikes.
That's Michael McCormack. He was a senior bank official and teller with NIB in Dundalk when the strike began. He was also the national treasurer and an active member of the IBOA.
No one knew who was going to stay in and who was going to stay out and who was going to pass pickets. And you see, you would know your customers personally. And a fella would be coming and he says, I apologize, Jesus, Michael, I have to go past you. I've got this cheque to come in or my business will go down the tube. And you could really understand, like, the customer was stuck in the middle of this thing. He had to make a lodgement to keep his business going. And he was apologising to the picketers as they went in. And we had stickers going up there, up the IBOA. And they'd go in to the cashier and they'd be wearing their stickers. You know, we support IBOA, but I'm going in here reluctantly because you'll bounce me cheques unless they do.
Just been into the bank, how do you feel about the bank strike?
Actually, it didn't affect us much, really. Things are quite there, are they?
Should be back at work, everybody. Every job to go to, and they should bloody do it, they haven't paid.
Have you been served inside?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they're very, very good. They've been absolutely marvellous. No waiting, nothing.
What shocked me was that strategically they just didn't see that at all. And it's kind of the words of one syllable. It was made very clear to them that the banks were not going to step back. The most marked example I had was on that particular Saturday. Bank of Ireland and AIB had pretty good plans in place in terms of their operations because they knew they would get quite a core of people across. I was with NIB at the time. We reckoned we only need to cross a threshold of a certain number to come in. Ulster Bank actually hadn't got as secure a position, but from a technology point of view, in terms of IT support, Bank of Ireland offered Ulster Bank support to get them over the thing if they had a problem with their technology centre. And on the Saturday afternoon, David Wendt, whom I work for now in Irish Life Empowerment, rang around each branch manager and said, you know, you're either with us or against us, and if you're against us, leave your car keys in the branch. They had their car by virtue of being a branch manager on the basis of being a manager. In most disputes, managers are on the side of the business. And I think really what David was saying, look, it's crunch time to make up your mind which side you're on here. And fine if you want to go out and dispute, but you can't expect us to leave you with your car while you're out in dispute. You know, you can't have your bread and eat it.
I had a bank car. When I went on strike, I was driving around in the car. I got a letter from my regional manager to hand over the car.
That's Pat Hegarty. At the time of the dispute, he was the manager of the Inchicore branch of Bank of Ireland in Dublin.
The letters got more and more threatening. Eventually, it was a little bit like deep throat. I was asked to bring it up to Stillorgan Shopping Centre and hand over the keys there. Eventually, I got a letter that told me that as of from 12 o'clock on a date, the car would no longer be registered in my name and that it would be collected, if I wished, by the district manager in Inchicore Car Park. And I was on picket. District manager came out to me, asked me for the keys. Car was taken, and that was it. I was left carless.
What we saw actually was huge intimidation that we'd never seen before. And actually managers used to advocate the bank's line and put pressure under a lot of staff. You had managers calling staff in on a one-to-one basis, asking them in some cases politely, in other cases far less politely, and demanding them to support the bank line.
And what about these indications that there was harassment at that instance?
Yes, there has been terrible intimidation here in Cork.
What kind of examples could you give?
Well, I'd prefer not to go into them, but you can take it that it has been pretty massive.
Have people been passing by the pickets?
People have been passing by the pickets, reluctantly, a lot of them.
Are you prepared for a long strike then?
Yes, we're prepared to stay out as long as it will take.
I mean, the subsequent events then is the banks then decided that by the 4th of April, unless staff signed up for the new agreement that the Labour Court recommended, that they would have no choice but to amend everybody's contracts. So what we then decided to do is call an all-out strike. And that strike started right across the banks for those branches that weren't in strike in AIB on the 6th of April and in all other banks. The mood on the picket line was mixed. It's fair to say that there was a lot of hostility. The bank put an enormous amount of pressure on managers in particular to bring staff in to work, and indeed went so far as to encourage managers to bring wives, spouses, partners and children into work. And that was a horrendous situation because you were working with colleagues for maybe in years, same union, same issues. And now you were outside picketing for what you felt was your right to have a union, because that's what the issue became. And to see somebody's wife, somebody's partner, somebody's child going into your job, and you out in the rain on the picket line. So it was a very difficult time.
When you look at this dispute by comparison with the other one, the thing that the IBOA totally underestimated was the fact that technology had moved to a stage that customers obviously couldn't get into banks in the 1970s because the doors were closed. And even when the banks were open, people might be nervous about crossing pickets and that, as happens. But people could go to a bank link and access their cash. And the IBOA totally underestimated the effect of that. And in fact, what happened during that dispute was that effectively the bank started to see that they could operate the branches with less people and operate quite effectively. In fact, the banks in the 6 weeks probably made more profit because they had no labour costs, virtually.
The Bank of Ireland claimed a short time ago that 52 out of 56 of their branches were operating in Dublin, while in Munster, 74 out of 82 branches were open.
The idea of picketers asking somebody to beep the horn in support, IBUA started that, I'm glad to say. And it was so bad in Donnybrook that the Gardaí rang IBUA in 93 St Stephen's Green. Could we ask the picketers not to be getting the public to beep the horns because it was causing huge difficulty for all the other businesses, couldn't do their work. There was tremendous stories of our members on 24-hour pickets because bank managers were bringing people in boot of cars and they wanted to make sure that anybody going in had to face them.
There was acrimony. People were vindictive to each other. And people that were harmonious, had a lovely working relationship in the bank, then came down and there was a split in the camp. It was like a war in the family, you know. People going out, not talking to each other. Families split up. Brothers and sisters didn't talk to each other.
What would annoy me a bit was that, I mean, I can respect somebody deciding to withdraw their labour, that's fine. But I think equally, if somebody makes a rational and responsible decision to come into work having weighed up the issues, then equally they should be treated with equal respect. And I don't think all of the IBOA people, you know, complied with that standard. And certainly people did endure a lot of abuse merely for taking a conscientious decision to disagree with their union.
During the strike, I was given one of the first mobile phones in the country and was walking around with a brick. I was making phone calls all over the country. The bank was orchestrating this and they'd have difficulty getting people to picket or work in their own branch. They said, well, you can go to another branch and you can do your work over there so you don't have to pass your own colleagues that you work with. And so this is the flying pickets thing. We used to get the guys over to picket them over there in the other place just to make sure we were vindictive and slag them and say, yeah, go on. Hell, slap it up you, you know, hope everything that gets to you, you know. So it got very acrimonious. Like, fellas travelled the length and breadth of the country just to annoy another member of staff who was passing pickets, you know. If you found a guy who was one of your colleagues and hadn't the bottle to pass your own picket, but had to go into Dublin to pass a picket, well, it sure as shooting, everybody in the branch went down to find that branch and make sure he parked his own colleagues. And we let him know what we thought of him.
It wasn't too much fun for me, I can tell you. I had five kids at a time. And, you know, it was very cold. It was lousy weather at the time. It rained incessantly. It was really, really miserable. And the general manager and assistant general manager used to come down to that branch, you know, and used to have conferences inside with the staff, looking out at us picketing outside. And I thought that was rather sad. It was provocative, but there you are. It was a dirty war, a really dirty war. And I suppose the sadness about the whole thing is that, a bit like the Civil War, really, you know, there are people who never got together afterwards. I mean, I had a lot of friends, and, you know, I'd have to say honestly that the relationship was never the same again with them. And that's 15 years ago.
From my point of view, you know, if you're in the HR game, it's a bit like washing your hands. Like, you know, you do it out of habit. You don't attach a particular emotional thing to it. But certainly people on both sides had very strong feelings both during it and after it because it was a watershed.
Efforts to resolve the 10-day-old bank strike may have suffered a serious setback. In a statement this morning, the bank said they would refuse to meet the officials' association until after it had balloted members on a revised Labour Court recommendation.
There was the odd bit of levity in it. One of the guys was picketing in Dublin, and the branch was a very old traditional branch, and the windows were very high, and so the inside they couldn't see the pickets. So he got a 12-foot stick, and he put the picketing thing up on this, and the boys were inside, and they would have been cocooned from the whole thing, except for they all had 12-foot high pickets up there that were going across the window outside, and this was done deliberately, and everybody was laughing their legs off at this type of thing. Can you imagine in a two-man branch that's a sub-office in Doura trying to picket that? But the guy was up there picketing on his own, yeah, in the middle of Leitrim, you know, and it didn't matter to anybody, but he was picketing outside the National Irish Bank in Leitrim. It was just, and somebody arrived up and says, what are you doing? He says, well, there's no one else around here, just picketing.
So how did the strike come to an end? Essentially, Kevin Duffy, then the Assistant General Secretary of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, now Chairman of the Labour Court, and Turlough O'Sullivan of IBEC negotiated a deal through the Labour Court which was acceptable to both the banks and the union. Brian Sheehan explains the crucial role those two bodies played in the final stages of the dispute.
At a national level, you could say, IBEC and Congress sought to protect the PESP, the national agreement of the day. In a way, they act as almost policemen for a national deal. We've seen that in other disputes, and it was particularly evident at that time. But the banks themselves couldn't be seen to break a national agreement. They weren't going to do it. The government wouldn't allow that. And Congress moved in to help out a fellow union, even though the union was outside its remit.
One of the outcomes of the dispute was that the IBOA did in fact become affiliated to Congress. But what, in real terms, was the outcome as far as the union members were concerned?
I suppose in monetary terms, our members didn't gain an awful lot. There's no doubt about that. If you look at it on paper, they had a claim for parity with managers who were well looked after. They didn't succeed in doing that. The banks responded by looking for longer opening hours. And the result was that they did get longer opening hours, and our members got a 3% increase in line with local bargaining at that time in the National Wage Agreement, and a lump sum for longer opening hours.
In physical terms, however, the biggest impact that the 1992 strike had on the IBOA was on its membership numbers. In the year after the strike, the 4,000 members who passed the picket during those 3 weeks were expelled from the union.
Well, that was the big issue, and I suppose the challenge for us as a union. What do you do with 4,000 people that had every opportunity to support the union, that the union had served well for many, many years? And the decision we arrived at, basically from the ground, that these people had to be expelled. And unlike any other union, I think, in the world, we took a decision between 1992 and 1993 to expel 4,000 of our members. And that was a big hit.
I do think it's one thing to win or lose an argument in industrial relations. In reality, the IBOA took the action of suspending all the members who had passed the picket. It's one thing to lose or win an argument. It's another thing to lose a sizable chunk of your members as a result of a dispute, because your membership are your strength.
But finally, in terms of the lasting legacy of that dispute, what exactly were the lessons that were learnt? Brian Sheehan again.
The IBOA is now a changed union and is boxing quite cleverly at the moment. I think the IBOA understands that a serious industrial dispute or a strike is no longer really on, and it's using different tactics these days. It's involved in a very important partnership relationship with AIB. It is, as you know, involved in a dispute at the moment over pensions with Bank of Ireland, and is using the state's resolution facilities, the Labour Court, to help them resolve that. So I would say that the IBOA has learned a lot from that dispute.
But what about the banks? What did they learn?
Well, the banks initially had to be very careful not to trumpet their success at the time and take stock of the situation. And looking at AIB in particular, you would say that AIB moved from being the bad guys in the eyes of the IBOA to being the good guys today, because they have a very successful local partnership arrangement with the IBOA. In terms of the Bank of Ireland relationship, probably more difficult. They have a dispute at the moment, as I said, over pensions, but it's proceeding, and the Labour Court has been involved in major intervention.
I've no doubt that had it not been that dispute, that within a couple of years there would have been a need for a dispute. The relationship had just reached such a level that no organisation like the banks could have continued to function without addressing that issue that was sitting at the centre, which was that the IBOA had become far too powerful in the context of the banks. I think it's a more balanced situation now.
It was a terrible, terrible period in the history of banking. Probably the worst experience that we've ever experienced in Irish banking history in terms of disputes. We've had disputes before, and we have them subsequently, but nothing of this order. I think on balance, certainly criticism is justified. We're all not above criticism. But I think we pitched it right, and I think the banks overreacted. And I think history will show very clearly that what they did was an overreaction to what could have been handled in a different and a more structured way.
That's all for this week. Next week on Passing the Picket, we'll be looking back at the 1990 strike in Waterford Crystal. So do join me then.
Our brothers and our sisters, many bar of lands, there is power in our union.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details, visit rte.ie/radio1.